Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Higashi, Program Manager of the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library. Thank you all so much for joining us on this glorious afternoon for this day with Lucia Perillo. We first thank Elliott Bay Book Company for co-presenting the program today, the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs, our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis, and finally, the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Late last year, Karen Maeda Allman from Elliott Bay Book Company asked me if this new book of stories by Lucia Perillo were on my radar. No. I'm a longtime board member of Copper Canyon Press, and I was certainly well aware of a new book of poems coming out, but not this fiction. I didn't even know that Lucia wrote fiction. So we, together with Elliott Bay, have been delighted to present Lucia Perillo here on previous occasions to read from her poems and her amazing essays from I've Heard the Vultures Singing, Field Notes on Poetry, Illness, and Nature, as well to honor her twice with the Washington State Book Award in Poetry for Luck is Luck and for Inseminating the Elephant. The latter was also a finalist for the Pulitzer. So it's a great pleasure to be able to welcome Lucia Perillo here today with stories from Happiness is a Chemical in the Brain and this new book of poetry, On the Spectrum of Possible Deaths. I will own up to some trepidation about opening this book of stories, but wow. So one of two boxed side-by-side starred reviews in Publishers Weekly said this: MacArthur Fellow and Pulitzer Prize nominated poet Perillo debuts a work of fiction in a lyrical short story collection that reveals a genius for plot and metaphor. Perillo strikes a glorious balance between wryly intelligent prose and emotional force, recalling Alice Munro at her best. This volume's vibrant stories demonstrate the full potential of the short story form when put in the hands of a true artist. And the poetry. Lucia's writing, of course, has won many distinctions, including a MacArthur Fellowship, the Bobbitt Prize from the Library of Congress, two prestigious poetry awards from Claremont Graduate University, the Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award, the largest generous prize given for a single collection by a mid-career poet, and also Claremont's Kate Tufts Discovery Award for a first book. I think I remember correctly that you were the first to win both of those. So how to characterize Lucia's poetic voice? Unique, powerful, smart, occasionally funny, often poignant, and always memorable. Here's what David Kirby, the poet, wrote in the New York Times Book Review. I have two words for anyone who wants to know why people turn to poetry in times of need. Lucia Perillo. She's the funniest poet writing today, which is saying a lot, since she's also the poet most concerned with the treachery practiced on us daily by our best friends and worst enemies, our bodies. So Lucia will read, and then she will sign books at the end of the program. So thanks again to Elliott Bay, and please join me in welcoming Lucia Perillo to the Seattle Public Library. Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming out on this great day. And when we were driving up here, it was a nice day for a drive and all, but I thought, well, no one's going to be at a reading on a day like today. So that, but I couldn't have predicted it when we were setting this up, of course. So, but I thank you all for coming when you have so many outdoor choices. First, I would like to read from Thomas Tranströmer, whom I've been reading a bit this year. I never really appreciated him, though I was dimly aware of his work, and I don't think I quite got it. And when I started reading it, I really liked it. So I want to read one little thing, and then I'll read a poem that I wrote most recently that plays off his poem. This is called Black Postcards, if I can find it. One, the calendar is full, but the future is blank. The wires hum the folk tune of some forgotten land. Snowfall on the lead still sea. Shadows scrabble on the pier. Two, in the middle of life, death comes to take your measurements. The visit is forgotten and life goes on, but the suit is being sewn on the sly. So here, now I'm going to read on June 5th for Open Books, and John at Open Books, he's going to make me a little broadside. So I had to write, his press is very small, and so I had to write him a short poem. And so I did it. I don't generally write very short poems, but I wrote one for him. So this is called A Little Death Suitable for Framing. T, the famous poet, tells us to be on the lookout for a tailor, not the reaper. We will know him by his well-made but shabby suit. And the sharp implement he carries turns out to be a needle. In the gloaming, we might see its tip, a speck of light created by the moon. Its long thread, of course, will not be visible until he gets up close. All right. Now, I'd like to read a story, too. Most of the stories in these books are set in a Northwest town, sort of like Olympia, but not really. This is a story that takes place in that town with a fictional backdrop of events that have never taken place in Olympia. I just say that because I'm getting reviewed in the New York Times, yay! And so I saw the electronic copy of the review, but I didn't like it because the reviewer took everything as autobiographical when it's not. And clearly this, you know, this isn't Olympia, if you know Olympia, for sure, this story. And these aren't me, neither of these characters are me. Cavalcade of the Old West. Though the two sisters had grown apart over the years, one routine they kept up from childhood was going together to the little fair that lodged itself for 1 week every August between the warehouses and the bay. The fair was nothing to write home about, curly fries, Ferris wheel, carny boys with broken teeth. But when they were kids, there had also been a hoochie coochie tent and a show called Cavalcade of the Old West, which held on through all the years of the girls growing up until the times changed. The Old West included Snow Gwish the Indian, who wore a fancy bustle made of eagle feathers, and a blind woman in buckskin named Bullseye Vi, who shot at targets with the aid of a minor bird. The bird squawked out directions left, right, up, down. Also appearing were left hand Zack the lumberjack, who'd been maimed in a logging accident and yielded an axe with the one arm he had left. Sam Pan the Chinaman juggled spikes that were rubbed with petro gel and set aflame. And Leroy the salmon boy, what Leroy did was smoke. Because Stella was older, she put herself in charge, and her practice of fair going as it evolved over the years led her to hold off on the Old West until the tail end of the night. First, she made Ginny prove that she could ride the hammer without throwing up after eating a whole caramel apple, seeds and all. Then it was on to the games of chance, where Stella stole softballs out of the bushel baskets and fired them at the pyramids of fuzzy clowns, while the carny screamed whatever obscenities were in circulation that year until Stella ran off with Ginny in tow. They were girls then, nimble and skinny enough to slip through the narrow spaces between the stalls. Behind the stalls, they trotted along the timbers that edged the wharf. Stella would kick off her flip-flops, the pads of her feet growing black with creosote. She laughed at the way Ginny flinched when the heron screeched and flew up beside them on the mud flat. At the wharf's north end, they came up against the backside of the Hoochie Coochie tent, where the girls dropped off the wharf to stand on the riprap piled below, so that their eyes would be level with the tent's bottom edge, which Stella lifted. Inside, the Hoochie Coochie ladies wore filmy gowns that Stella called negligees. That means nightgown in French, she explained. The ladies paraded around while the barker made embarrassing claims about their bodies. If she gets up running and comes to a stop, she'll jiggle like a bowl of jelly. The women giggled, but the girls could tell that their laughter was fake, and not because they were being wounded. No, they were only bored. And it was from within the cocoon of their boredom that they took off their negligees one by one. Though the promise made out front was that the men who paid to come inside would get to see the women naked, Stella had already clued Ginny in on the fact that this was just a trick. Under the filmy gowns, the women wore two-piece bathing suits made of spangly iridescent satin with scarves attached that were also tethered to their wrists. Whenever a man tried to touch them, the women would use the scarves like dental floss, slicing between their bodies and his hand, drawing the arm away with the scarf, as though the scarf were a kind of net. Sooner or later, the girls would be spotted peeking under the tent, and the barker would kick their heads just hard enough to drive them off. By this time, it would be late enough that Stella would permit them to go to the Old West. One time they got there just in time to see the minor bird go wild, the blind woman chasing it by following its squawks. The Indian stood impassive at the edge of the stage while the minor bird lunged in his direction, apparently recognizing its distant cousin in the wheel of ragged feathers that the Indian wore on his butt. And the one-armed logger was no help, drunk and goading the bird with the stub end of his axe. But Stella's fixation lay with the salmon boy, who throughout the pandemonium just sat there and smiled, swaying a little, adjusting the plane of his face until his heavy glasses caught the light and sparked. He was, in fact, an armless, legless black man of indeterminate years who wore a green satin shirt modified to make the stumps of his arms look like fins. His act consisted of his rolling a cigarette in the trough between his nose and lip, lighting it by curling one stalk from the matchbook backward onto the flint. Like the rest of the crowd, Ginny drowned her horror in polite applause when at last the gray plumes shot from his nose. Over the PA there'd come a blast of scratchy trumpet as he smoked. Then everyone beat a quick retreat, everyone, that is, except for Stella. Leroy would bow for her for as long as she was willing to clap, until the barker told her to get lost. That was when they were young, of course, because in later years, Leroy was gone, and not just Leroy, but all the denizens of the Old West who became the disabled, or Asian Americans, or First Peoples, and were moved on, fobbed off, put away somewhere else. And in this renovation, the Hoochie Coochie women were also driven underground. Ginny imagined them wandering the rainy streets in their negligees like wet moths. The Old West was replaced by various booths that urged civic improvement. In the New West, everyone recycled their newspapers and cans. The water district gave out low-flow inserts for people's shower heads, and the city demonstrated the newest in compost bins. Even the wildlife department came with some brochures about the perils of DDT and a few mangy birds of prey, to which Stella shrieked, "Caw, caw," until the young woman on duty told her that if she was going to annoy the bird, she'd have to go away. Ginny always insisted on being the one who drove because the fair, especially the fair, had a way of pumping Stella full of the black humors that made her manic and angry all at once. Running on a high test was how Stella referred to these moods, which Stella traced back to Leroy, but which Ginny suspected had more to do with the likelihood of her running into one of her ex-husbands. Sometimes it seemed that the fair existed just to give her husbands an excuse to knock each other around. More often than not, by the time they approached its purest dark and the kids in safety patrol bandoliers came through swinging their flashlights to herd the crowd home, one of the husbands would be towing Stella toward the car. Then Ginny would have to drive home while the two of them grappled in the back seat. Whenever a car pulled up behind, their bodies would flash if a strobe light had hit them, lighting Ginny's rearview mirror. They'd be engaged in some exotic form of either sex or warfare, but Ginny had long ago run out of patience with her sister to care which. The next time Stella called, she'd sound contrite, though she would feign ignorance about the cause of Ginny's hurt. What she said was always a variant of, "I mean, I'd understand if it weren't my husband." "You mean your ex-husband," Ginny says. "That makes a difference?" "You have many ex-husbands, Stell." "Several. You're resorting to hyperbole." "Then I'm sure you could tell me which one it was," Ginny says, hating the school teacher, which she is, which she'd become, that she could not jettison from her voice. "Stell." "Okay, okay." This was Stella's standard apology. "Whatever it is that I don't remember I did, I promise never to do it again, unless I don't know what I'm doing when I do it." The Old West lasted until the girls were teens, by which time Stella had taken to carrying a flask in her embroidered shoulder bag that was spangled with tiny mirrors. Whatever was in the flask made Stella hoot and holler, "Bring on the fish boy, let's have Leroy, let's see him roll that cigarette." And when he was wheeled into the stage's brighter lights, she'd applaud more wildly and stamp her feet. She was wearing a skirt that she'd made from an old pair of jeans, the hem frayed, barely reaching the top of the V of her legs. It was that time of evening when the bay flattened its surface and turned silver, the last trace of sunlight mixed with the first trace of moonlight to create a dusty paste. Ginny was 11 that first year of the flask, with only a vague idea what drunk meant. But the word was juicy enough to make the stardust cling to her sister's body, which seemed full of mysterious sap that garbled her words and caused a few strands of her dark hair to stick to the corners of her mouth. Then she started shimmying in more or less one spot, while Leroy grubbed his lips through his tobacco. In a kazoo voice, she sang, "I'll be your hoochie-coochie girl, you'll be the jelly man," while her arms swung and her fingers snapped. "That girl's out of control," said a woman in the crowd as she looked around for someone in a position of authority. But under their breath, the men sucked their teeth and whispered, "Oh, baby, and come to Papa." Estella shook the new round breast that had snuck up on her so quickly that she did not even seem aware of them yet. "Come on," Ginny said, touching her sister, but Stella shook loose. "I'm not out of control. I know exactly what I'm doing." Ginny tried to stand so as to block everybody's view of her sister. "So what are you doing?" she asked under her breath. Stella was pedaling her arms and wobbling her hips, submerged in the sweet liquor that filled her, swimming through it with her eyes closed and her breath held. "Dancing," she said without coming up. What happened in the years that came after the end of the Old West was that Stella dropped out of high school, messed around for a while, then took the GED and ended up getting out of college with a degree in accounting before the rest of her class, facts that she recited often and with a quack of glee. She liked to make up jokes at the expense of the other members of her profession, like, "How many accountants does it take to screw in a light bulb?" Answer, none, because they make the receptionist do it so that when she climbs up the step ladder, they can all look up her skirt. She said the reason she chose accounting was because it did not require any thinking that could not be performed by a machine. Like 6 + 7's thrown me ever since the great brain cell die-off of the 80s. And you know what? It doesn't matter anymore. They've got software that can compensate. And in this matter, Stella won. Rich men came to her with their receipts, and she owned a number of Goodwill suits that she now wore to work. But for the fair, her short skirts were still made of denim, though store-bought now and finished at the hem. She liked to wear them with flashy heels and the colors, whose names Ginny remembered from the big crayon box, fuchsia, celadon, cerise. She also wore sunglasses, an extra pair of which she once tried offering to Ginny. "So you won't be afraid of running into any of your kids or their parents," she said, "just in case you decide you'd wanted to cut loose." "When have you ever known me to cut loose?" "Hey, Jin, I figured there's a first time for everything." Ginny made the comment that she was not the sister who usually needed a disguise, but this made Stella shake her head. "No, you don't need a disguise when people see you wearing one every day. Get me out of a suit and no one has a clue." "I was thinking more about your husbands." "Oh, them." Stella waved her hand in front of her face as though she were shooing away a cloud of gnats. "They already have their ideas about me." That was how the Old West ended. That night, Stella did her song and dance, "I'll be your hoochie-coochie girl, you'll be the jelly man." After everyone scurried away, it was just Leroy on the stage, puffing a cigarette while Stella whooped. The Barker rolled his eyes. "It's that girl again, your number one fan." Leroy squinted and tilted his heavy glasses before he said, "Let's have a look." Then he made the Barker push him down the ramp so that he was there with the sisters on the wharf, peering up at them through his thick lenses. He looked at Stella, then Ginny, then back to Stella again. "That's what I call groceries," he said. Up close, Ginny could see that his shirt was cheap and crudely stitched. When Stella asked if he wanted something to drink, he scratched his shoulder against his chin, which had a few black hairs, too sparse to qualify as a beard. "I suppose I could do with a Coke," he said. Ginny was dispatched to get it from the concession stand at the other end of the wharf, and while she waited in line, the evening dimmed. By the time she was headed back toward Stella with the cup in her hand, the bay was more black than silver where it stretched across the opening between stalls opposite the Old West stage. Farther north, on the other side of the bay, sat the pulp mill lit up like a steamship, its stacks churning out the vapors that reduced everyone who ventured down to the waterfront in those days to tears. She could not find Stella at first. She was not where Ginny'd left her, though eventually she spotted the wheelchair tucked behind the skee ball booths and a shooting gallery. Stella was sitting slantwise on Leroy's lap, her white shirt hanging on the back of the wheelchair, where it fluttered like a flag. Ginny knew that her sister was the one who'd done the unbuttoning, the salmon boy's fingers sealed inside his fins. "Whoa, double trouble," he said when Ginny approached. But Stella was only annoyed. "What are you looking at?" she snapped. "Oh, that was years ago," Stella says, waving her hand across her face. Again, the gnats. She has her bare feet on the dashboard. She's using the ear stick of her sunglasses to dig mud from between her toes. The reason for the mud is that at around 10 o'clock, Stella had grown annoyed at the way her heels kept getting stuck in the cracks between the planks, and she'd flung her shoes off the wharf, hollering after them, "To hell with you!" That's all it was, a woman standing with one leg crossed behind the other to peel the shoe off her heel. Then other leg, other shoe. Then they both get fired into the drink. That's all it was, a woman taking off her shoes and flinging them into the sea. And yet seeing this somehow made Ginny forget, for a minute, all her sister's petty offenses. After all, wasn't Stella right? Weren't her transgressions petty? So that what remained was everything about the fair that did not change. The cotton candy like cheap pink wigs, and the smell of frying onions. The boys with giant stuffed animals on their shoulders that they'd won for their beloveds, though the conquest had cost them $100. "Hey," Stella says, "you know why accountants always want to meet girls they can bring home to their mothers?" "Why?" Stella stops digging to look up at Ginny. "Guess." "I give up." "You always give up. Just tell me." Stella wipes the ear stick on the dash before popping the sunglasses back on her face. "Maybe I don't feel like it anymore," she says sulkily as they idle in the car waiting for the traffic to clear from the parking lot. "Here's the difference between you and me," Stella says at last. "You'd be embarrassed if you were me, but I'm not. Even when I was a kid, I knew exactly what I was doing. When I'm 90 years old and peeing in a bedpan, that night with Leroy will be how you remember me, and don't tell me it won't. When it comes to you, I'll be 14 forever. And how much would other people give for that, huh? To be 14 forever? If I could bottle that, I'd make a mint. Ginny doesn't answer because she's still thinking about her sister's shoes, ebbing in the sound, bright red. Meanwhile, Stella takes the flask from her expensive leather coach bag and drains the last swig, the flask being another thing that hasn't changed, though she keeps better booze inside it these days. Anyway, Stella continues, wiping her lips with the back of her hand, that's why you always come back here with me, though I'm bound to drive you nuts. There's always a chance that I'll be able to come up with something that'll top having my tits licked by the salmon boy. I don't think so, but you never know. Maybe someday that old Indian will reappear and you'll catch me bawling him. Or the blind lady, she quacked. Then there's quiet in the car for a while. So what's the answer, Ginny says. Answer to what? The girls and the accountants and their mothers. But Ginny can tell that Stella is already bored by the accountants. Huh, she grunts. The answer is because they still live with them. But see, it's not funny anymore. That's what happens when you give up. All the funny goes away. By now, the traffic has filed out of the parking lot, and when Ginny pulls out, the fare lights in the side view mirror blur into one smear. They're headed north along the shore road, though this is not the direction home. Ginny's just glad to be driving with no husbands, with her sister in the front seat. So where are your husbands tonight, Stell? She asks. And when Stella says, who? In a rednecky voice, Ginny can't help but laugh. They're history, Gin, I swear. Sometimes I can't even remember their names. Then Stella sticks her head out the window and shouts, Leroy, to the night. Isn't it strange, she says when she pulls in her head, that someone you love can dry up and blow away like an old leaf, whereas 10 minutes with the salmon boy is something that I never will forget. They've come out of the trees and hear the house lights shine on the bay's far shore, marking the contours of the hills. The far shore is also where the mill sat, lit up like a steamer the girls once claimed someday would carry them away. When they were girls in the pulp mill days, the air smelled so sour that a whiff of it could bring tears to your eyes. But it's been years since the pulp mill burned, and now the air tastes clear and sweet. And thank you. I'll read a few poems from my new book. I have a service dog, but I didn't bring him. He has cancer in his snout, tumor in his snout, so... He's a goner, so it's really interesting to be, you know, and he's perfectly fine, very puppy-like in other ways. He's 9 years old, so he's an old dog, but he doesn't really act like one. So it's odd because I've never nursed a parent or anything to be, you know, with this creature, this being that's got its numbers, His days are numbered. But so are all our days are numbered, you know, so I think. But anyway, I've been reading these poems about dogs. I wrote a poem about the dogs in the Iliad and a poem about the dogs in the Odyssey, and they're both in this book. I felt I had to write about the Iliad so that I'd remember it, because I've pretty much forgotten. But this poem's about the death of Achilles has killed Hector. Achilles was not getting involved in the battle, and the death of his friend Patroclus had taken his armor and was fighting on his behalf, and he was supposed to be somewhat invincible because of this armor was magical, but I think his helmet fell off or something that allowed him to be killed. And so after Patroclus gets killed, Achilles jumps into the war and slays Hector. And so this is about the death of Hector. The second slaughter. Achilles slays the man who slew his friend, pierces the corpse behind the heels and drags it behind his chariot like the cans that trail a bride and groom. Then he lays out a banquet for his men, oxen and goats and pigs and sheep. The soldiers eat until a greasy moonbeam lights their beards. The first slaughter is for victory, but the second slaughter is for grief. In the morning, more animals must be killed for burning with the body of the friend. But Achilles finds no consolation in the hiss and crackle of their fat. Not even heaving four stallions on the pyre can lift the ballast of his sorrow. And here I turn my back on the epic hero, the one who slits the throats of his friend's dogs, killing what the loved one loved to reverse the polarity of grief. Let him repent by vanishing from my concern after he throws the dogs onto the fire. The singed fur makes the air too difficult to breathe. When the oil wells of Persia burned, I did not weep until I heard about the birds, the long-legged ones especially, which I imagined to be scarlet, with crests like egrets and tails like peacocks, covered in tar, waiting the feathers they drag through black shallows at the rim of the marsh. But once I told this to a man who said I was inhuman for giving animals my first lament. So now I guard my inhumanity like the jackal who appears behind the army base at dusk, come there for scraps with his head lowered in a posture that looks like appeasement, though it is not. I've got another one about dogs. I'm like an inmate who I get my vocabulary from my reading, and so I can't pronounce anything. This is called Les Dauphins. The dauphins are the inheritors of the feudal kingdom, right? The dogs of the childless are barely dogs. From tufted pillows, they rule the kingdom. They'd stand for their portraits in velvet suits if they had suits, holding hats with giant feathers, and ousting the question, who loves the dog more, the question becomes, who does the dog love? The woman says, you are the one who plays him a drum, you tap the anthem on his head. No, the man says, you debone him the hen, you tie the bow of his cravat. The dogs of the childless sleep crosswise in bed. From human hip to human hip, a canine wire completes the circuit. The man says, I wonder what runs through his head when he squeaks and snarls all through his dream. And the woman says, out of the dream, I'm in his dream, riding the hunt in my lovely saddle. When the masters are gone, the dogs of the childless stand in the mirror with swords on their hips. They'd stand for their portraits with dogs of their own if we were kings, if they weren't dogs. And I'll read one about a coyote, which isn't quite a dog, but it's sort of. We used to have this coyote that lived in my neighborhood, and it's a very suburban type of neighborhood, but I don't know, the coyote was somewhere tucked in there. I think it's met its maker now. Domestic. Here the coyote lives in shadows between houses, feeds by running west to raid the trash behind the store, where they sell food that comes in cans yesterday expired. Picture it perching on the dumpster, a corrugated sheet of metal welded to the straight, its haunch accruing the imprint of the edge until it pounces, skittering on the cans. It has tried to gnaw them open and broken all its teeth. Bald-flanked, roomy-eyed, sniffing the wheels of our big plastic trash carts, but too pigeon-chested to knock them down, scat full of eggshells from the compost pile. I am like that, starved, with dreams of rutting in a culvert's narrow light. We mumble our affinities as we vacate into sleep. Because we occupy the wrong animal, don't you too feel it? Haven't you stood in the driveway utterly confused? Maybe you were taking out the garbage, twisting your robe into a noose knot at your throat when you stopped fighting the urge to howl and howled. And did it bring relief, my friend, however self-deceiving? The last poem I'll read is this poem, Pharaoh. I don't write a journal so much anymore because my hand doesn't work that well. But the one time I have my journal and I'm like set up and ready to go is at the doctor's waiting room. So I have these poems that I've written of doctor's waiting room poems. And this is about at Virginia Mason. Well, but they have aquariums in most doctor's offices, so. Pharaoh, in the saltwater aquarium at the pain clinic, lives a yellow tang who chews the minutes in its cheeks while we await our unguents and analgesics. The big gods offer us this little god before the turning of the locks in their formica cabinets in the rooms of our interrogation. We have otherwise been offered magazines with movie stars whose shininess diminishes as the pages lose their crispness as they turn. But the fish is undiminishing, its face like the death mask of a pharaoh, which remains while the mortal face gets disassembled by the microbes of the tomb. And because our pain is ancient, we too will formalize our rituals with blood, leaking out around the needle when the big gods try but fail to find the bandit vein. It shrivels when pricked, and they'll say, I've lost it, and prick until the trouble's brought to the pale side of the other elbow from which I turn my head away. But Pharaoh, you do not turn away. You watch us hump past with our walkers, with the tennis balls on their hind legs, your sideways black eye on our going down the corridor to be caressed by the hand with the knife and the hand with the balm when we are called out by our names. And hey, well, thanks again. I bet you can't wait to get outside now, but
is that really it? One more?
One more poem? Okay. Yay! I'll read this other poem I had marked called, this was in the New Yorker. It's called This Red T-Shirt. So it's one of those poems where the title runs into the first line. This red T-shirt was a gift from Angus, came with his new Harley, which no ladies deigned to perch their buttocks on, and was therefore sold minus the shirt. Net cost $3,000. I wear the money in my sleep. The black braid flowing from the man, herding dice at the Squaxin's Little Creek Casino, cost me $235, well worth it, for the word croupier. Work 7 months on a poem, then you tear it up. This does not pencil out, especially for my mother, who ate potatoes every day from 1935 to 41, who went to the famous Jackson Pollock show after the war. Sure, she was a rube from across the Harlem River, snickering at the swindle of those dribbles, until death squelched the supply and drove the prices up. I've known men who gave up houses worth $500,000 just to see the back of someone whom they once bought diamonds. And I've known women to swallow diamonds just to amplify the spectacle of their being flushed. The Gutenberg Bible, okay, I get that. $5.4 million for a book of poems written by God on the skin of a calf. 100 years ago, the Squaxins could tell you easily who the rich man was. He'd be dressed in a red robe made of epaulettes from red-winged blackbird wings. And I'll explain that last line comes from the ethnographer Malcolm Margolin, who lives in the Bay Area, and said that the Indians down there, who were the Ohlones, the sign of wealth was garments made with red from blackbirds, because that out west where we don't have cardinals, that's the only real red you can get, is that little speck on that wing. So that's the end. Yay! Yay!
Thank you all so much. Thank you, Lucia Perillo. Just really a thrill to have you here and to hear you read.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.